You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Slate's Audiobook Club. The month is July, and that means that the book under discussion is Imperial Bedrooms, Bret Easton Ellis' sequel to Less Than Zero. My name is Troy Patterson. I'm a critic writing about television and such here, and today I am joined by Stephen Metcalf, Slate's critic at large. Stephen.
Troy, thank you.
And our third is Slate editor Michael Agger.
Hello.
So we've got two books under discussion here, both the new book, Imperial Bedrooms, and the classic, we'll call it. We'll start out by calling it a classic and then decide if we're going to demote it in the course of this discussion, Less Than Zero. Steve, you were just perhaps bemoaning during soundcheck that you're perhaps struggling in the middle of writing a Bret Easton Ellis piece.
That's right, Troy. I'm supposed to write something about the new book in relation to the old book, and I'm writing a book about the 1980s, and so this would apparently be directly in my wheelhouse, hit it out of the park, knock out 1,800 words, and go hit the links at 3 p.m. And I find myself struggling over it. The truth is, there isn't an easy way in which I apprehend these books as debased and awful. I certainly don't see them as clearly meritorious or literary. I'm having all the troubles I think one has with Bret Easton Ellis, that Bret Easton Ellis himself has with Bret Easton Ellis, which is this, you know, it's very hard to fix his place in the literary firmament. It's very hard to pin down exactly what the purpose of these books is and what's being accomplished by them. I think the origins partially are in Bret Easton Ellis's literary celebrity, which started when he was very young. This was a book that he wrote effectively as an adolescent. It was published his second year. The first one, Less Than Zero, was written effectively when he was an adolescent, published when he was 21 at Bennington College in, I think, his sophomore year. And he was made famous very early for catching a particular moment, a moment in which kind of heartless sex and drug abuse could be glamorized, but in a very particular way, in this kind of toneless, affectless manner that his prose is famous for, that captures a kind of nihilism. The fact that the narrator isn't thrilled by the promiscuity and by the hard drugs, I think, is much more important to that book than whatever thrill he's getting from it. And by contrast, I think I recently wrote about Jay McInerney, who also has written a bookend book, right? A book that, you know, McInerney also became famous in the 80s, right alongside of Bret Easton Ellis. They were pub crawlers together. They hit Page Six routinely side by side. And McInerney wrote a kind of bookend to the 80s book that came out recently called How It Ended, right? This sort of self-conscious valediction to this era that gave them both their literary celebrity. I find McInerney as a writer very easy to fix. McInerney is a guy who wants you to think that he's part of a debauched or a debased moment and reports the news coming from the frontier of that debauched moment. So he goes to the club, he takes the cocaine, he dates the models. But he's effectively a literary Puritan and a would-be comedian of manners. Whether he succeeds at that or fails at that, there are differing opinions. But I feel like that's who McInerney is. He's working both sides of that street. Bret Easton Ellis, Mike, I have to say, I can't quite get it, pin it down in a way. That there's a poker face, a very self-conscious literary poker face, game of poker face going on, and I lose it every time when I read Bret Easton Ellis.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly get the sense when reading this new book, Imperial Bedrooms, like, you know, it just could all be a con. I'll take that back. You know it's a con, and you know that Ellis is conning you. But then you're like, okay, we all know that. So, you know, I'm aware that he's conning me. And then it's sort of like a higher level, well, do I, like, agree to participate in, like, the conning?
What is the nature of the con, would you say?
I mean, I just think, you know, it's not a legitimate attempt to write a sequel to Lesson Zero. It's like, it's sort of floating on the publicity of Lesson Zero and you know, inviting you back into this world in a way that's, you know, he hasn't even tried to reimagine it. It's just another kind of artificial journey with these characters. And I think, you know, there's a literary mindset that would be repelled by that I think Ellis is sort of daring you to kind of, as he always does in his books, to be like, well, oh, you know, hey, that's a kind of a cool affect, you know, that I like the, you know, it's repulsive and he's not trying, but, you know, we should look at ourselves and see why that annoys us, you know, why are we so interested in originality and those sorts of anyway, what was your feeling, Troy?
My feeling about the book, the new book, Imperial Bedrooms, my first thought is that Knopf has a lot of Knerve, asking people to pay whatever the list price on this book is, $26, $27, for what is at best a novella. And at best it's in a novella, and I think that it's the slimness and slightness of the book is hardly limited to the page count. This is an extremely thin story. And so maybe we can get some traction here by talking about sort of the plot such as it is. In the first book, our narrator and anti-hero, Clay, was a college freshman back in Los Angeles for a month on Christmas break and suffering from just a sort of vague spiritual anomie. Is that what we're going to call it?
I'm in.
Yeah. existential dread, disconnection from his family unit, is numb on a wide variety of drugs and pop music, and his friends are drug dealers and prostitutes.
But we should say rich kids who are getting in, dabbling in drugs and prostitution.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. These are the spawn of movie business mockers.
Right. It's not a Baudelairean, you know, tour of the gutter. Right. I mean, it's about the rich kids of Los Angeles.
Oh, it's a very nice gutter. Yes. It's the gutter of Beverly Hills. And so yes. So back then, Clay was a sort of numb young man, and kind of interesting. I think that first book worked because of sort of. He had a distance, right? He was sort of among all this low living and taking part of it sort of wholeheartedly. It's a cold heart, but wholeheartedly. But still he felt sad and bad. And with just enough of sort of the flatness of affect, I think, is what sort of saves the book, sort of the dryness of the tone. So as horrible things are happening and sort of drug overdoses and snuff films. There's nothing sensationalistic about the tone, which I think made it go over well. It was nice and cool. And also, if you'll forgive me for saying, for using the word relatable, it was kind of easy to get into the book as sort of a depiction of a kind of adolescent mind, even if, you know, your own sort of trips back home from college where you feel this distance from your family and friends. If in Lesson Zero, these moments are happening at Spago's with cocaine. And, you know, even if in your own life it's like Burger King and Bud Light, there's still something to speak to you there. This is a long-winded way of saying that was Clay. Now it's 2010. Clay is back in Los Angeles. He is a screenwriter's had some success. He has not kicked the anime thing, nor his substance abuse problems. And so those are kind of his companions as he ventures around Los Angeles. The book should be, this is one of the many ways in which the book is disappointing, it should be a whodunit. Sort of, we know up front that people are going missing, people keep disappearing, people want things, people need things, there are cars following cars. It sounds like it should be a plot, but it isn't, in fact, because nothing gets discovered. There's no sleuthing. There's no investigation. There are just these sort of like periodic revelations leading to sort of a small holocaust in Palm Springs.
Right. I would add two things very quickly to that. One is that the book begins with a, I think, possibly neat and clever postmodern trick, which is that Clay claims that he's the real Clay, that the book was produced by Bret Easton Ellis, by someone else who was a writer who was hanging out with them, and now he can pick up on the sort of true story. He says the novel was relatively accurate. The movie was a kind of travesty. So there's this way in which you get thrust back into the real world, the quote-unquote real world, or the fictional world is made to seem real by this person disavowing the book to some extent and saying, I was impersonated by a writer who hung out with our crowd. The second thing I would say is I absolutely agree that the first book was written with a kind of remarkable discipline for a writer in his late teens and early 20s, in the sense that it never cracked a smile and it never broke that placidity of affectless surface, which is what carries the book, I think, the first one. The second one does crack that surface, and not in a way that irreparably damages it, because there is an evocative L.A. noir, which Bret Easton Ellis, over the last 20, 25, 30 years, has learned how to write quite well. And so it is evocative of a certain style and of L.A. noir, and a certain fact of L.A., that it's a large, sprawling, electric and sinister town built around the business of show business. But having evoked that, right, where does it go? There's this sinister atmosphere, Mike. It's just atmospherics, right? It doesn't really – it grabs you but then takes you nowhere.
Yeah, I guess I would say that was one of the more dated qualities of the book. It's just like, since the original Less Than Zero has been written and now this book, it's like, you know, there's some people have really thought through, you know, how movies and kind of living for fame can be extremely alienating and kind of self-eating. And, you know, they kind of have these sort of B-movie types populating this book and just being their motivations being totally kind of convenient and transparent. It was, you know, they're just getting shuffled around L.A. They didn't really take us anywhere surprising, although, you know, as usual, Ellis was willing to kind of provide snuff film-like details to keep us jolted.
What do we think of that? I'm a big fan of American Psycho.
Snuff.
But that's for a different podcast. I remember myself as a big fan of American Psycho. I was young when I read it. I believe that I wrote a term paper writing about it in connection with Dostoevsky. I certainly have no interest in rereading that term paper, but I'm confident that there's something interesting and meaningful in that approach to sort of ultra-violence.
Well, I guess I would say I'm like an old-fashioned reader in the sense that, you know, I like to be kind of enveloped in the fictional reality. And, you know, I always take the kind of extreme gore and violence to kind of Ellis trying to kind of awaken the Puritan within you and to kind of make you feel uncomfortable and see how you react. And I don't know. I just don't. It's not taking me somewhere. I wasn't. I don't. What do you think of that stuff, Steve?
You know, it fails to. It fails to connect with me aesthetically at all. Even though I recognize that there's this building contrast between the tonelessness of the prose and the, you know, vividness of the violence and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That, you know, an axe is being taken to my frozen inward sea or something. But it fails to break or melt that at all. But I will say that there is a second plot or a sort of second core to the book, which I found way more interesting than the violence, though it overlaps with it eventually, which is his relationship with this young actress named Rain. And certainly it's riddled with cliches as well. But it seems to me one of the things that Ellis is getting at is that for whatever reason, Clay is made enormously vulnerable by this woman. He becomes obsessive about her. And it's almost as if he's fallen in love with her, but Ellis is trying to take the measure of the internal damage of Clay by the fact that he can only play a game of control with her, in which he tactically dangles the possibility that she'll get a part in a movie that he's writing. And then when she fails to, you know, he basically extracts a term of sexual servitude from her by dangling this promise. And when she becomes distant, you know, he becomes cunning and coy about the possibility of her being in the movie. And that this takes up a lot of the book, is, you know, his obsession with her and the origin of it. And I thought that could have been an interesting story. I mean, it could have been the story of how fucked up this guy. I mean, it is the story of how fucked up this guy is and what he does in lieu of you know, normal human intimacy. At the same time, it just seems loaded down with hackneyed impulses. Troy, what did you think of that part of the book?
I'm with you on that. And in one sense, this all the book is sort of an elaboration of the old joke about the actress who was so dumb that she went to Hollywood and slept with the screenwriter. And on the other, there is a little bit of attention that's gotten between. Well, let me see if I can just sort of extract sort of two bits of dialogue from the book.
While you're doing that, I will say that Ellis hasn't lost his gifts for great names, and I think we should. I was wondering if we could all adopt have a poor name. If you could have like an Ellis name
generator,
an Ellis name, that would be wonderful. And I was trying to think of one
that's a great idea.
Like a Thadley, or
I think I'd just have to be Troy.
Troy actually does
it already,
bit,
right?
So early in the book, someone says. Sort of Clay and to him. I think Clay is very pragmatic. What's unbelievable is clinging to a fading belief in love. And then later, when Rip is chastising Clay, said, could it be that you actually get off on the fact that because of how you've set things up, they'll never love you back? They being the sort of the actresses who Clay serially abuses. Could it be that you actually get off on the fact that because of how you've set things up, they'll never love you back? And could it be that you're so much crazier than any of us ever really knew?
Ouch.
I say that aloud, and it's even pulpier than I'd realized the first time.
I know. You read it aloud. That's the thing. You start reading it aloud, and you start to see it better for what it is, right?
I will say, though, I like it when Ellis brings the details. This sort of – I like the Rain subplot the best, like you did, and just sort of the description of her – life, sort of the constant texting and kind of angling into parties and like who was there and who wasn't, and then sort of the way Ellis describes the landscape of young actors in Los Angeles, and just there's this great scene where the Clay character sort of propositions this young actor and says and makes it very clear to him that hey, if you don't go home with me, I'm going to make certain that you don't get this part, and the young actor sort of immediately replies, "All right, dude, let's go." Right. Just sort of this, and Ellis has this great line where it's like, the instantness of the reply was the creepy part, and sort mm-hmm. of, and having not spent time in these clubs and circles, I can't say whether it's true or not. But his evocation of that milieu, I thought was very compelling to me in the book.
I totally agree. And he gives you the sense of this, and this is sort of a little bit of Nathaniel West, but he gives you this sense of an absolutely huge country, right? Bumper cropping every year, a new set of new cohort of 17, 18, 19 year olds who all just go on a bus, to Hollywood. And they're competing against one another in a pitiless Darwinian struggle. And for any leg up, they'll fuck anything on a moment's notice. And there is a tremendous pathos to that. He milks it a little bit self-consciously, which is too bad. And that's where we pick up with Rain, and where Rain could be interesting because, she's given a real name. That's a fake name. She's given a real name at one point. He finds out what it is, and there's something just – there's like – He names her beautifully because it's a completely un-Bret Easton Ellis name. It's Donna something. Does anyone?
Yeah, you're right. It's Donna Zarelli or something. Go ahead.
But giving her this name, he gives you this tiny glimpse into the anonymity this woman is so desperate to shed, which I think is quite powerfully done because it's so minimally indicated.
Denise Tzarek?
But then he screws it up completely in my mind by having every other person in the story obsessed with her as well and fighting over her, giving you the impression suddenly that there are only five people in the world and they all want to sleep with her and they're all murderously competing with one another, including his therapist. To my mind, that got very peculiar.
Yeah, for a bunch of drug-taking nihilists, they all love the same face. It's
exactly. And he doesn't convey what's so unique about that face in a way. He does make her sort of a generic, Hollywood, hottie.
Sure. I've got one idea for you, though, Steve, for your piece.
Which I'd is love that it.
One thing that's...
it's one more than I got.
One thing about the book, both that makes the prose go over and does something to give the book some thematic coherence is that it seems always to be operating in this cinematic register to the prose. in terms of the sort of the pace and the nature of the description and the way that the visual description is meted out, but also in its, you know, there are these direct references to Sunset Boulevard and to Contempt, to think of a couple movies mm-hmm. about movie making and cynicism. There's, you know, one scene that's sort of set at the, you know, the Griffin Observatory, which we think of from Rebel Without a Cause. And there are sort of lots of moments where the characters seem to be alive to sort of the moviness of their situation. Mm. You know, people saying things like, are we going to play out another scene? That's just another character you're playing. What movie do you think you're in?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if this is the self-consciousness of characters in a postmodern novel, or is it the super self-consciousness that people who live and work in Hollywood actually have? You know, everyone in Los Angeles feels himself to be in a movie.
Mm-hmm. Aspiring to both, maybe. Another thing I really liked about that, and I totally agree with you about that, is the narrator Clay is very discerning when it comes to movies and very critical when it comes to movies. In addition to being cynical about the paycheck and, you know, and just going through the motions and getting remunerated to a preposterous degree for crappy work, but there are many scenes in the movie where he's watching a movie and Rain is relatively indifferent to it. And he's picking up on where the plot just completely gives out and collapses. It's two or three times, but it's this interesting indication that craft is something this writer would like to bring to the business of making movies as the writer. And he doesn't really have a chance to do it, but he hasn't abandoned aesthetic standards, even though he's living there. You know, so there's every indication that Clay is trying to maintain some sense of aesthetic rectitude in the face of commercial vulgarity. But is this something we really trust Bret Easton Ellis to have maintained in the face of his own literary celebrity? What do you think, Troy?
I do indeed. And I think that this is why I will always pick up a Bret Easton Ellis book, despite the manifest flaws of so many of them, is that he's quite I believe in him as a stylist, which, you know, and any good stylist is going to be at least a part-time charlatan, and I'm okay with that. He's especially proficient at sort of these good rhythmic endings. He can do a dying fall, and he can do sort of the deft step away. And so I'm going to read a paragraph now that sort of illustrates what I contend to be Ellis's talent for the kind of the smooth getaway from a paragraph. And I don't even know if I need to contextualize this paragraph. It might actually hurt if I did. In any event, Banks closes his menu when the owner leans down and whispers something to him. Josh Hartnett, who is going to play one of the sons in The Listeners and then bailed, walks over and crouches by the bamboo chair, and we have a brief exchange about another script of mine that he's been circling. But his apologetic lack of commitment only makes me seem more remote than I'm actually feeling. Though I know that what he's saying isn't true, I smile and agree anyway. Austere plates of raw fish start arriving, along with ice-cold bottles of premium sake, and then the guys make fun of a very successful shark movie I wrote, and the series about witches I created that ran for 2 seasons on Showtime. Then Wayne starts telling a story about an actress who stalked him until he cast her in a movie about a monster that looked like a talking beanbag. Just as the owner sends the table a complimentary dessert, an elaborate plate of sugared donuts drizzled with caramel, the night begins sliding into its last act. I'm scanning the room when I see the cascade of blonde hair, the wide-open pale blue eyes, the dumb smile that offsets her beauty while at the same time making it more pronounced. She's on the phone at the hostess stand, and then I realize it's time to cross the line. Now, there are good and bad parts to that paragraph. There's status details that are maybe at once telling and hackneyed. I think that was a good joke about the monster that looked like a talking beanbag. But what puts it over is just the kind of the rhythm to it and the motion of it. I like his sense of he's got the beat. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's so utterly itself in a weird way. You have to respect it, right? I mean, it's so utterly of that moment when or comes out of that moment in the 80s when these kinds of distinctions suddenly became enormously important, when we started not only going to see movies but reading about how they were made, who made them, and how much money they made making them, when the kind of culture of glamour and therefore the sort of roping, the VIP roping off of a certain kind of person from the rest of us really took off. It really did take off. You wrote a magazine profile about a famous person in a very different way in 1985 than you wrote it in 1975. The premises were very different. And it made sense that there was going to be someone with a vestigial literary sensibility on the front lines of that reporting to the rest of us what it's like with one foot over the rope and one foot not over the rope. And Ellis and McInerney filled that role. And I guess one has to kind of go with it a little bit and accept that it captured its moment and we live with it for better and worse. But I can't follow Troy in some way. It still turns my stomach.
It's like watching a good video, I feel like. You know, it's like it kind of is what he's describing. You know, it's just sort of like you'll just be kind of cruising along with Ellis and then just be kind of a great moment where like the details and the rhythm, as you described, Troy, sort of connect in a way that, you know, like a good song and video can. And then, you know, I'm right there with him. But
and to be clear, Steve, I'm talking about the skills that he brings to the table that allow me to set my critical judgment aside and to slide along that surface with him.
Yeah. No, I'm completely with you.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, writers tend not to hang around certain places. You know, I think that's why Ellis is interesting. I mean, there's a tradition of obviously people, writers kind of gazing in on Hollywood and writing about it. But, you know, writers tend not to hang around law firms or, you know, insurance offices or, you know, and I just think like, you know, Ellis has a good vantage point, partly, you know, based on the celebrity of the original novel. You know, he's got some good windows to look into.
But I think part of the game is given up when he tips the poker hand a little bit. And let me give you an example from this book. He writes, so many people died last year, the accidental overdose, the car wreck in East Hampton, the surprise illness. People just disappeared. I fall asleep to a song from the past, hungry like the wolf, rising faintly above the leaping chatter of the club. I think he lives near a club and he hears it from his bedroom window. Transporting me for one long moment into someone both young and old. Sadness, it's everywhere. Right, lethal. It kills the whole thing. It kills what's good about it, right? I mean, it reveals even what's good about it for what it is in some way. Or am I being too harsh?
Yeah, I mean, it's like for any kind of real emotion to seep in here, you feel like he has to have this kind of major tidal wave of, you know, it's almost like he's like running up next to the cliff and like, you're right, like every now and then he jumps off and you're like, oh man, like why do you do that?
Yeah. It's the discipline of withholding the emotion or the disgust or the affect that makes Ellis Ellis. And when he cracks in this book, Troy, he totally cracks, the ending being the most obvious example of it, right? I mean, he gives away the whole candy store as far as I can tell. I mean, how do you recover from the last sentence of this book?
You... A glass of Kettle One,
exactly.
I think is what Clay would do.
Exactly, and another big fat check.
Should we read that sentence, or should...
Can we?
Is that like...
Oh,
I mean, we can't really spoil this book. I mean, you know, it's like... you know where you're going from the first page, but...
Well, why don't you read the final paragraph?
Mike, do you want to read?
Sure. There are many things Blair doesn't get about me, so many things she ultimately overlooked, and things that she would never know... And there would always be a distance between us because there were too many shadows everywhere. Had she ever made promises to a faithless reflection in the mirror? Had she ever cried because she hated someone so much? Had she ever craved betrayal to the point where she pushed the crudest fantasies into reality, coming up with sequences that only she and nobody else could read, moving the game as you play it? Could she locate the moment she went dead inside? Does she remember the year it took to become that way? The fades, the dissolves, the rewritten scenes, all the things you wipe away. I now want to explain these things to her, but I know I never will. The most important one being, I never liked anyone, and I'm afraid of people.
I believe him.
Yeah, I believe him too. I mean, that's part of the problem, right?
I mean, you know, when I read those words, could she locate the moment she went dead inside? I mean, that's sort of when the kind of the internal sigh comes over me.
That's when you went dead inside.
Exactly. I went dead inside on page 168 of Imperial Bedrooms.
Right.
I'm just trying to think of the meta. It's like, it would be like if the Pretenders came out with a new song or something. You know, it would be like you could play the same kind of notes and the same kind of lyrics, but
Right. Well, and that you mentioned
out
lyrics.
Out of time. It's the wrong time.
Yeah. And there's a way in which also I think it's kind of easier to get away with this sort of thing when you're writing about teenagers, when you're writing about 18, 19-year-olds and less than zeros. The bar is lower. And just to that Hungry Like the Wolf reference, the references to pop music in that book and the invocations of it seem so much more sort of natural and fitting because they're kind of appropriate to the overwrought sort of self-dramatizing way that teenagers think about their lives. In this book, it's just like a movie soundtrack.
Yeah, and also he's brought in this ultra-violence in the background in order to keep the book from feeling really slim. I mean, let's face it, from making it feel like an episode of 90210 or The Hills, right? Both of which, in some ways, we can thank Bret Easton Ellis for, right? So he's brought in the specter of Mexican drug cartels and mass graves and people disappearing, and he's being followed. He's being sinisterly texted over and over and over again. I like how in the original Less Than Zero, a person's face sort of, when he doesn't know what to write, someone just lights up a cigarette, right? And in this one, they text, and they both kind of light up faces in darkened places in similar ways. But having brought in this kind of this enormous sense of danger from something extremely worldly and consequential, which is Mexican drug cartels and, you know, Rip's connection to people who will kill you if they care to, he then still keeps it an episode of 90210, right? That specter is raised in order to give the book some heft and some sense of consequence out of, like, you know, Blair still really likes you. She really still likes you. I mean, these people are in their fucking 40s, and like people are saying Blair still really likes you. And in order to keep that from seeming as banal as it obviously is, he brings in violence and something I think we should talk about. I mean, this is a spoiler alert. I mean, a big moment in the book is he sells his supposed friend Julian completely down the river, feeling like he's been sold down the river emotionally by Julian over this woman, Rain. And essentially, he gets him killed, right? I mean, he signs the death warrant on this guy, which is supposed to make us blanch in horror in a way. But you believe him when he's reporting from the front lines of rich kid drug abuse. You don't believe him the way you believe Joseph Conrad, you know, when Conrad's reporting from the front lines of the Congo, you know, the interior of the Congo. Like, you don't feel as though Bret Easton Ellis has experienced these things or seen these things in some way that gives him an authority on them. You feel as though they're writerly tricks, and you see exactly how the rabbit got in the hat. That wasn't a question.
I think this is the point in the meeting where we, like, you know, the third act really needs a rewrite, and you bring in, you know, Steve Zalian or something to, you know, make it happen.
Right. Does this book have a claim to being literature? It's in this weird nether zone where this is not sort of like satisfying.
Yeah,
poem.
No, that's right.
It's not. There's a pot is put on to boil, but it does not really matter what is in it, right?
So I think if Ellis were here, we're being way too fussy. Yeah, we're not understanding the kind of, you know, games that he's playing. You know, that's. But
do you buy that?
I guess I don't buy it because I agree with you in the sense that, you know, he does try to go for genuine emotion in this, and certainly trips up at that at those points. So
yeah.
You got to be all game or not, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a weird answer to your question, mm-hmm. which is, I think, like, it passed through filter number one in a weird way, which is the culture needed a young person to write from the front lines of 80s amoralism and give a display of what young privileged people were thinking because A Catcher in the Rye was no longer going to suffice. And in some way, I think the culture wrote that book in a weird way. I mean, obviously, Bret Easton Ellis wrote it, but the need at that moment to have that book was very powerful, and it elevated that book, and the book was up to the moment, right, in a weird way. The only way I could see a second filter doing something for this book is if some thermonuclear event kind of wipes out most of the species and most of our species' memory, and a millennium hence, you know, this and a few other things survive, and people are really trying to recapture what it was like. You know, in a weird way, this is evidence of what life has been like over the last 20 years in some kind of twisted way. If it passes through some completely arbitrary filter and it's the only thing people have in the year 3000 to look back on, you know, whatever our period was leading up to the pushing of the red button, not red buttons, the comedian, but the red button that blows us. But you know, it'll tell people something about the way we lived. Sadly, I mean, it's pathetic and sad, but it'll get it something real. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm going to deflect that question by asking Michael if he buys that.
Yeah, no, I think, I'm in the year 3000 and the button blowing everything up and you come across Imperial bedrooms. What would you know? I mean, I guess, again, you know, I think Ellis is traveling among people who don't read. You know, there's never any mention of the news. There's no current events. I mean, it's kind of this timeless movie space. And, you know, like, there are lives like this and people like that. You know, who live like that, and there's a certain fascination in reading about that and wondering how true it all is. So yeah, I guess I'll go with Steve. I'll be there with the forensic anthropologist 1,000 years hence, and say that Ellis will have some use describing our moment. I mean, you know what? I love your point about the original Lesson Zero, how, you know, the culture sort of wrote that book, and it was buoyed up by this need to replace Catcher in the Rye. And I'm curious, Steve, like your thoughts about, you know, both, you mentioned McInerney earlier, like they both kind of struggled with that burden. What do you make of that, you know, when you kind of get that touched upon you, you know, just starting off? And,
oh, boy.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a funny one. I mean, one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I was reading about Ellis, who I knew very little about, I had never read Lesson Zero, was Jonathan Lethem was, I don't know if he was in his class at Bennington, but he may actually well have been. It was Donna Tartt, I believe.
Yeah, they were there together.
Yeah, it was Donna Tartt and Bernice Ellis and Jonathan Lethem, and they didn't perceive Lethem because Lethem never advertised himself as a writer. And say what you want about Jonathan Lethem. I mean, Lethem allowed his talent to develop. He allowed himself to not grow up in public, you know, maybe by his own volition, maybe not, and eventually made something out of his own, you know, rather peculiar childhood in Brooklyn, rather unique childhood in Brooklyn, made arguably vastly superior books to Bret Easton Ellis's, because they didn't go with that grain. You know, he didn't try to become part of a literary Brat Pack. And so I think you have to pay the if you're going to get all the benefits of speaking for your generation and being timely in a somewhat arbitrary way, you know, have to pay the pay the piper as well. And the downside of it is you date very easily. You're known for your public immaturity in a way, and you wear your success as a 21-year-old a little bit like a millstone for the rest of your life. And I think these are just facts of Bret Easton Ellis's career as a writer. But Troy, you're a bigger fan than I am. I want to hear a defense. You actually think he's a compelling writer.
Well, what I will say, Steve, what Bret Easton Ellis gives to me is that I'm interested in him as sort of a poet of Los Angeles and as a poet of the perpetual apocalypse that Los Angeles is. You know, New York needs to continue to be blown up in the movies over and over, because that is what we need psychically from New York in the movies. There seems to be this presumption among everyone that the apocalypse in Los Angeles has been started, like, when they put the Hollywood sign up. I think that there's a cultural need for us to be told by Nathaniel West or Joan Didion or whomever else sort of how awful these people are, and we need sort of the creators of our dreams to suffer. And I think he makes them suffer very nicely.
Yeah, I don't know. I've certainly, like, been slagging Ellis a little bit too, but I have to say, like, the book is, like, very readable. You mm-hmm. know, the kind of noirish elements definitely draw you in, maybe not with the payoff that you want. And I think there's also an element to Ellis, maybe partly because of American Psycho, like, you know, he feels a little dangerous. You know, it's not often you pick up a book and you're like, oh, well, I'm not really sure what's in this. You know, it's not going to be nice writing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the M-dashes aren't going to line up. You know, it's like, it's going to be, you know, he's going to, you know, you're going to get the knife in the back every now and then.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah,
it's like you're slumming in a Mercedes, basically, is what it is.
That's just the final word. I mean, there's nothing left to say.
Yeah, with Elvis.
I mean, guilty pleasure is a tricky term, but am I working towards an answer to my earlier question before about does this rate as literature? Is that it's, you know, it kind of appeals to a couple of different prurient interests, but there's, you still feel that there's an intelligence and there's a human sensitivity back there behind the narrator's sort of numbness that is just enough to keep my interest. I don't know. I read Imperial Bedrooms in one sitting and was largely dissatisfied, but I certainly do not regret having read it, and it will not deter me from reading his next book.
Yeah.
Does that make me a sucker? Does it speak to my own human weaknesses?
All right, I'll make my final run at the reputation such as it is of Bret Easton Ellis, and then I'll hold my peace. Hemingway once wrote, "If a writer of prose knows enough of what he is writing about, he may omit things that he knows, and the reader, if the writer is writing truly enough, will have a feeling of those things as strongly as though the writer had stated them. The dignity of movement of an iceberg is due to only 1/8 of it being above water. A writer who omits things because he does not know them only makes hollow places in his writing." I think the defense that Bret Easton Ellis has always implicitly and I think explicitly offered for his work is that, well, my work is about hollow places, right? And therefore, this emptiness that you feel is exactly that the tip of the iceberg is the whole thing, even though it suggests greater depths. And that's the trick that he's playing, right? And there is something Hemingway-esque about his discipline of omission and affectlessness of tone. And he's trying to make a statement about a lost generation. I think A Sun Also Rises is much more in the background of Less Than Zero than Catcher in the Rye. And I don't buy it. That's where he loses me. And I think that that's where you have to either go with him or not go with him. You know, you're willing to say, well, what he knows are those hollow places and that emptiness in a weird way. And therefore, you can't finger him for it. But I think you can. I think you can absolutely say it's portentous. And the second that you crack a smile or let in a real emotion, which he does in this book, the whole subliterary fog blows out over the Pacific. And I think that's what's happened with this book. So there's the negative case as strongly as I can state it.
All right, so it seems like we've made some progress towards helping you out with your piece here.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to this Sofia Coppola adaptation. It'll be wonderful.
So then Stephen has achieved some greater clarity of thought on the subject, or glib clarity, as the case may be. Thanks for your effort and time, gentlemen.
You're very welcome. Very fun.
So then for the Slate Audio Book Club, I'm Troy Patterson, and we'll play you out with a little Hungry Like the Wolf. Rock on.